WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything can go on.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this special New Year's Eve edition of the Sunday Spin for December 31st, 2017, the last day of the year. Welcome to our weekly look inside the world of politics and policy from City Hall to the State House and all the way out to Washington, D.C. Go grab that Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your 2018 off to a great start. Well, happy new year to everyone, and I think we can use one.
Yes.
Just my take on things. It's going to be a busy year next year, and we'll talk more about that later, but I hope you guys all had a good Christmas out there, and Dave and Sam.
Yeah, we did. Sam, Christmas is, next week?
Serbian Christmas, January 7th.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that will be, Saturday?
Monday.
Monday. Okay, week from tomorrow.
Yeah.
So you'll be off that day.
Merry Christmas.
I might work that day. We'll see.
Oh, okay.
What? Serbian Santa has a very strong work ethic, Rick.
Thanks for letting me know.
He's got really hairy arms, too. And he doesn't have a beard. He's got a mustache.
It doesn't come down the chimney, right?
No. No, he breaks through the window. Yeah.
Lovely.
Oh, what a picture. Yes. What says holidays more than Serbian Santa
Merry
breaking
Christmas.
Through your window?
Good morning.
Well, the final day of the year, the final Sunday of the year, the final day of John Fox's coaching career as the coach of the Chicago Bears, I'm assuming. I mean, I know there are plenty of reports out there, but the Bears' final game...
We've had those reports for a long time.
But the Bears' final game of the season against the Minnesota Vikings today.
Oh, Sam was looking up broken glass sound effects.
No,
there.
Santa's in the newsroom right now. Oh, here he comes, coming for me.
He heard, yes. Be careful.
I've been naughty.
You're on the list. You're on the list.
Well, gentlemen, all I can say is that it's a good thing the Bears are playing inside, because in Minneapolis right now, it is 14 below.
Oof.
14 below, and they're only going to have a high of 6 below.
So, Rick, let's just say this, and let me give you credit first and foremost, because last year you said the Bears would win 4 games, they won 3. This year you said the Bears would win 6 games, they're right at 5. You've been right there. You've literally been right there. I mean, you get it better than the paper predictions.
Well, I have to admit, the Bears, for me, these last couple of seasons are kind of like the period where I went away from the Blackhawks for a while, and I would just look at them from afar. I wasn't caught up in every minute detail of what was going on, and I am a Bears fan. I want to be a Bears fan, but you got to give me a reason to be a Bears fan. And, you know, Trubisky, I hope, is, a bright light in the future. Decent players, but this is just, these past 2 years have just been an embarrassment. And an embarrassment in a big football town, because no matter what anybody says, still, the Bears get the most eyeballs when it comes to sports.
And the 85 Bears still walk on water.
They do. They absolutely do.
Yes, they do. Sam, did you hear any final numbers as to how many no-shows there were last week at Soldier Field?
They announced, it was funny, John Williams and I talked about this on Saturday. He said probably 10,000. I set the number at 17,500.
Right.
And they announced 17,350 no-shows, but I really think there were more than that. They announced that there were 17,000, but if you watched that game and looked around that stadium, Schwani, it looked about half full.
Yeah.
And capacity's over 60,000, so you do the math.
Right. Well, there you go. I mean, I was guessing under 40,000 for the game. I just had that feeling that, I'm glad they won. and I think I predicted they were going to lose. But
I think we wanted
to give Cleveland the first victory of the season.
Yeah, just well, because they were favored, remember? And yeah, we were just going by the pattern of the Bears being favored under Fox, and they lose every time they were favored. So, and so Minnesota's already in the playoffs.
Yes.
So are they even going to play starters today?
Yes, because they're still playing. I believe they're only a game up in the standings on the third-place team. So they're playing for a first-round bye.
Okay. So they have something to play for.
Yes, today. They do. They're not going to rest their starters. Yeah, the Vikings are 12-3. The Rams and Saints and Panthers are all 11-4. So Minnesota has to win this game to get a first-round bye.
Okay.
The Eagles are going to bench their starters. A couple other teams.
I saw some
Patriots
Steelers
probably.
Might.
Yeah, the Rams are not going to play their starters because they don't want to face the Vikings. I think they want to lose so they can play the Eagles because the Eagles don't have a quarterback anymore.
Right.
Their starter went down. So it's all chess right now in Week 17.
Okay.
But the Bears might not score. I don't think they're going to get to 13 today.
What's the over-under today?
The over-under, I'm not sure about. Let me check that real quick. I know the spread is 12. Minnesota's favored by 12. The over-under is 38.
Ooh. So, all right. So
Vegas thinks about 24-13.
Yeah.
24-10.
Well, maybe I'll watch a little of it. Actually, this is so rough for me today, and you know, you've got all of these great bowl games going on, and the Blackhawks are playing tonight in Calgary because nothing says New Year's Eve
like Calgary,
Alberta. I wonder how you celebrate in Calgary.
And I wonder what time they'll be celebrating in Calgary. A couple hours behind us, so I think it'll be around 2 a.m. here.
That's Western Calgary. Canada, right?
Right.
Yes.
That's correct.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And let's see. In Calgary right now, it's 21 below.
I was going to say, it's got to be below, below something.
13 below, so they will have no problem keeping the ice in place tonight.
No need for the Zamboni machine tonight. Wow.
Exactly.
But I got to tell you, this Jeff Glass, speaking of breaking glass, Jeff Glass, you know, 32 years old, was a draft front. There you go, Jeff Glass, who was born in Calgary, by the way. So he's playing, you know, at home. But I thought he had a fantastic game, and it was nice to see the Hawks kind of pick up for him, except for the last couple of minutes in their victory, their overtime victory at the end of the week. I mean, you could tell they were being protective of him at some points until, as I said, the final 2 minutes of the game when Edmonton tied it up. It's such a great opportunity for this guy. And I think he made 40-some saves in that
42.
Game.
That was the most saves by a Blackhawks rookie in his debut since Eddie Belfour, Eddie the Eagle.
Yep.
He had 45 in 1988.
But
this rookie is 32.
Yeah.
Did you catch
32.
The backstory?
Not really.
He played in Russia. He was in the KHL for 7 years, and he would travel through snowstorms in Siberia to go to practice or go to games. After 7 years in Russia, away from his family and friends, he went in the minors, went to the ECHL,
right,
then the AHL. And if Corey Crawford doesn't get hurt, Jeff Glass may never play in the NHL.
Right, right.
So this has been a career journeyman throughout, not only the minors, but in the pro leagues in Russia.
Yeah, because I think he got drafted like in 2008.
He's the same age as Brent Seabrook.
Wow.
They played in juniors together in Canada.
Man. Well, good for Jeff Glass, and good for this opportunity, and please take advantage of it. And it's nice to see the Hawks finally getting a win, and they just got to get back home. I mean, this has been an extended road trip, and it hasn't been a great one. And it's almost like circus tour kind of days is what it reminds me of. Time to get back home on the ice.
They'll be home on the 5th.
Yes. And
is that the next game after this one?
No, the next home game is the 5th. I don't know if they have a game in the middle. I'm not sure about that. I got the schedule right here. So they're home. Let's see. Yeah, they play. Let me get back to you, Shawnee.
Okay.
We'll get back to that.
This calendar in the sports office is a year old.
There you go.
For 2016. Yes. Great.
I can give you that schedule.
Yeah. Happy New Year 2017. Thank you very much for the sports department.
We have our stuff together for sure.
Dave's here to keep
us
up. Would
you like a new calendar?
They play the Rangers on Wednesday in New York, and then they're back home Friday against the Vegas Golden Knights.
That could be fun.
Yeah.
That could be fun. At least they won't be getting the Vegas flu because it's a Chicago game for once.
So. I'm going to throw this schedule from 2012 out right now.
Break some
12?
Break some glass with that, will
from
you?
1950.
Jeez, 1950.
Glenn Hall. No, like that.
There wouldn't be that many games on there, trust me. There'd only be we'd only have six teams that we'd be talking about.
Lloyd Pettit has your pregame coming up 7:30.
He was great.
Yeah, he's the guy that
he was great.
Helped turn me into a Blackhawks fan was Lloyd Pettit.
And the fact that you wanted to be a hockey announcer.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Those were the days. And listening to the transistor radio. Because, of course, you couldn't watch them on TV.
Nope.
So,
the Hawks are playing the Quebec Nordiques tonight.
What?
No, I'm just going back in time.
You must be.
Yes.
All right. Fast forward, Sam.
Of course, Hawks and Flames tonight.
Hawks and Flames.
Yeah, minus 16 below weather.
Hawks against the Flames, not Hawks and Flames.
Well, maybe both.
Come on. Enough. Dave's here to keep us up on all the news. Sam has the latest sports, including the 2014 schedule of the Blackhawks that he'll run through. Producer Casera is here to field your phone calls at 312-981-7200. You can text us at 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. On Twitter at @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is here making his New Year's resolutions. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to speak to Cook County Treasurer Maria Pappas in a few minutes about this whole issue about prepaying your property taxes. So you're listening to the Sunday Spin special New Year's Eve edition on WGN. Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to a special New Year's Eve edition of the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue. A chilly, chilly Sunday morning, and conditions don't look exactly much better for the rest of this week. It's going to be bitterly cold wind chills tonight, as well as throughout the week, including tomorrow on New Year's Day. Well, rather than take a weekly spin through the past week in national politics, I thought we'd start out by taking a look back at 2017. And ABC News did a review of the top headlines of 2017. We're going to actually come back to that in just a minute. We've been looking for a call from Maria Pappas, the Cook County Treasurer, and I'm glad to say that, Treasurer, welcome to the show.
You know what, Rick? I need to tell you something. You're not going to believe this. You're the only media outlet that knows this because we just found it out. Are you ready?
Go ahead.
We hit $106,628 million yesterday.
How much?
106,000 people.
Yes.
Paid $628 million as of yesterday.
Wow.
And last year, we had 1,700 people pay $14 million.
So we're $628 million.
Yeah, I mean, this is like, and it's all coming in while I'm sleeping or not in the office. It's amazing. It's like, seriously, like, of the 100,000, like 60, almost 70,000 of them came in online, downloaded a bill, direct debited their account, which is like the new trend. I don't want to talk to anybody. I don't want to deal with mail. I don't want to deal with the stamp. I don't want to have to come into your office. I don't want to have to go to Chase Bank. This is an absolutely new trend.
Well, and of course,
and we're open today. Another new trend. I mean, I'm open today to handle anybody who doesn't know how to pay online.
Right. And, well, let's remember, we're talking about the issue of prepaying first installment of property taxes in Cook County. This primarily result of the changes in the new federal tax law that place a $10,000 limit on what you can deduct from on, as far as property or local state taxes.
Right. So what's new here? What's new here is I think we're probably one of the only people in the country. Normally, you would be getting a bill from me in March.
Right.
And you would pay it in March. You can go right now to my website, which is cookcountytreasurer.com. You have until midnight. And once you get to this website, all you need to do is put in your home address. You don't even need your property identification number.
That's a good call there.
Yeah, just because nobody knows.
Right.
Nobody knows what their PIN number is. I mean, they would have to go try and find a bill, and they don't know where the bill is. So now, just put your address in, and up pops a bill. This bill becomes downloadable if you don't want a direct debit immediately online or pay by credit card online. You can download it, go to a Chase bank, download it, come to my office, download it, mail it in, postmark it by this evening. So I know you're in and out of Springfield a lot. They're probably going to dissolve the treasurer's office when I'm done with this program. Okay, get rid of her.
Electronic, yes, it's all electronic now. But
yeah, it's electronic, and people are happy. I mean, people are calling and they're responding, you know, and they're saying, you know, this is so easy for me. So you don't pay until March. You don't have to pay until March. But think about that. For the first time in the history of Cook County, your bill is online. You don't even have to get it in the mail. And we've had 200,000 people sign up for e-billing. In other words, they don't want any mail. This is like, I think you and I were around when the lines used to wind around the county building.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So here's the test of strength today, okay? We have a skeleton crew coming into the office, including me. I'll be there. Let's see if anybody shows up, if we're going to be, like, sucking our thumbs all day.
Well, leave the Bears game on in the background or something. But
Yeah, so if you don't have anything to do, come to 118 North Clark. Maybe we'll have non-alcoholic champagne sitting there or something. You know what I mean? This will be interesting.
Now, I mean, there was some issue about deductibility that had been raised by the IRS in the guidance last week, and it was about taxes as to when they were assessed. But this is actually, this is from 2017, this payment, technically.
No, this payment is, we're 1 year behind in
right.
Cook County. We're always a year behind because during World War II, nobody got billed. This payment is 55% of 2016.
Okay.
That's what this says. This is the actual amount payable and assessable in 2016, which gets confusing because we're 1 year behind.
But nevertheless, the fact is that it would fall under the guidance that the IRS set.
That's the assumption that many accountants and lawyers are making. So you need to check with them. Be sure. But we've got 101,000 people who said, you know what, I'm going to do this and this makes sense. I know what we're not doing. We've had 174 people mail in a check that exceeds the amount that we know. This we're not taking an estimated amount. So if the internet says 4,000, that's it. So people will send in the stub for 4,000 and they'll send in 8,000. We have a program which allows us to reduce the amount of the check to the amount that's on the stub, and then we send a letter. So probably Tuesday or Wednesday morning, 175 people are going to get a letter saying, nice try.
Yeah. Can't blame somebody for trying, especially when it comes to getting a break on your taxes. That much we all. Now, how late is the office open today?
We're open until 5, and then after 5, we have a drop box, and we've, you know, made these beautiful blue and white signs. So we've talked to the county. Anybody who wants to walk in can come straight to 118 North Clark, enter immediate right. There's a drop box.
And the website for people that want to do this online? The
website is cookcountytreasure.com.
That's Cook County Treasurer Maria Pappas. Remember, today is kind of the deadline if you have the wherewithal, if you have the means, and want to take advantage of the the rapidly shrinking federal tax break when it comes to paying local and state taxes. Obviously, you've got $626 million worth of reasons to do it so far.
You know, I haven't seen that much money in a long time, Rick.
Be judicious with it. Be judicious with it. Happy New Year, Treasurer.
Okay, Happy New Year to you, too. Take care.
You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's The Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. This is a special New Year's Eve edition of The Sunday Spin. And joining me here in the Allstate Showcase studio in Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue is Democratic State Senator Tom Cullerton from Villa Park. Senator, thank you very much, and Happy New Year to you.
Well, Happy New Year to you, Rick. Happy New Year to all your listeners. Thank you for having me on today.
Well, I wanted to have you on. We ran into each other at an event recently, and you're the chairman of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee.
Yes.
And on January 9th, your committee, as well as the counterpart House Committee, are going to be having a joint hearing on the issue of Legionnaires' disease at the Quincy Veterans Home.
Yes.
The Quincy Veterans Home is the state's oldest veterans home. Dates back to, I believe, 1886,
right,
if I'm correct, down in Adams County. And in 2015, there was an outbreak of Legionnaires' disease that killed 12 people.
Right.
And more than 50 others were sickened by it.
Correct.
And due to some very fine reporting by my friends over at WBEZ, certain facts have come to light about instances involving that initial outbreak.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is that each year there have been new instances,
right,
of Legionnaires' disease.
That's definitely correct. And Quincy is sort of our flagship veterans home. And this will be a joint hearing between the Senate and the House. The House committee is Representative Chapalavia. She is the chair of that. And then we'll be having those down at the Balandic building. The incidents first obviously started in 2015. The state has spent, and the governor and the Veterans Administration have spent over $6 million in trying to change out and adding a new water treatment plant, shutting down certain things. But yet it came back again in 2016. The Veterans Affairs, the VA, the Veterans Administration, and the governor went down and said, look, we've got a handle on this, and this won't happen again. This is the safest water and the safest place that you can have in Illinois, and yet a year later, almost to the day, we had six more instances, one of which resulted in another fatality.
And that was three more instances than they had initially reported.
Well, and initially they reported they only had, they said out to the public, there was only three instances that happened, and then through obviously the reporting of Tony and Dave over at NPR and WBEZ, they found out there was actually six. So they reported out there were six, and now since they've changed how many cases there are and said, oh, no, you're right, there were six. And again, one of them resulted in another fatality at this veterans home.
I was looking at the Department of Public Health released a couple of additional follow-up reports,
right,
that involved the Centers for Disease Control.
Right.
And I was taken aback by one of them, and I think this was a 2016 follow-up visit, where they talked about how with some of the new water treatment equipment, including, I think, particularly new boiler systems,
right,
that the showers and faucets have special filters.
So I went down, correct, I went down and visited, and what actually they do now is not only do they have a whole new water treatment system, they shut down the initial cooling tower, or the water tower that was on the facility. And they've added at every shower location, they actually have a second filter now. So the water comes through, and then they've got another filter that's attached that they say they are replacing every 30 days. So that's supposed to be a final piece that can screen it out. But again, the CDC just did a report, and thankfully 47 out of 48 locations didn't have it, but another location did have leaking.
And it was behind the filter.
And it was behind the filter. And
so that means there's still a source somewhere.
It's still a source, and it's still coming in there somewhere.
Well, what I was taken aback was in 2016 when they put these filtration systems into the shower heads and whatever and fired up those boilers. That though, they're, as you say, they're supposed to be changed every 31 days. That's kind of the manufacturer's. But when they first fired up these boilers, they were changing those filters every 31 minutes because of all of the gunk in the system there. And, you know, we are dealing with a facility that's obviously, you know, dating back to 1886.
Right.
You've got century-old water pipe systems.
It's century-old water pipes, and you have an aged population.
A vulnerable
population, for sure. A vulnerable population for pneumonia, which can also, which also is very damaging for that age group. But the fact is that the pipes are incredibly old, and I don't know if they've actually gone out and looked at what it would cost to replace all the piping within the facility. Now, we did have one number thrown out by the head of Veterans Affairs who said it would cost $500 million. But I've looked at sort of the diagram, and you've seen the same CDC report where they show all the piping and everything else. I can't imagine it would cost, I mean, even if there's 10 square miles of pipe to replace to cost $500 million is absolutely unheard of.
Well, and I'm certainly no plumber.
Right.
I mean, you know, my dad was an electrician out in Villa Park.
There you go.
But, you know, you see in projects here in the city, obviously, where they're, and they've been doing a lot on water line in Chicago.
Right. Well, Chicago, we were doing all the lead testing and everything
but
else.
But of slipping in, using the old pipe is basically
the
kind
frame.
Of a conduit, kind of, and
correct.
Slipping in a sleeve, which that, I mean, has anybody looked at that?
The Metropolitan Water Reclamation District does that. They do the sleeve of the plastic lining piping inside of the old pipes, and essentially it goes through scrapes, and then it's a new plastic lining inside the old pipe. They've got it up on their website. I don't know if they've looked at those options. I don't know if they've looked at any options. The only thing I've ever heard of replacing the pipe was the $500 million number. Part of the reason why we're doing the hearings is because we're not getting all the answers, and we're not getting everything that's been said and everything that's been told.
We're speaking with Democratic State Senator Tom Cullerton of Villa Park. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, and joining me here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Democratic State Senator Tom Cullerton of Villa Park. We're talking about the upcoming hearings that the House and Senate Veterans Affairs Committees will be having regarding outbreaks of Legionnaires' disease at the Quincy Veterans Home. The governor has been adamant that the state is doing everything that it can, that Legionnaires' disease, the Legionella bacterium, is something that it occurs in many parts of the state. That it's, you know, despite the best efforts of remediation, it's hard to say you can ever entirely do away with it. But yet, when you look at the Quincy Veterans Home, the fact, and one of the troubling aspects for some is the fact that the first outbreak back in 2015 was reported in late August. CDC comes in, and they trace it actually to a month earlier.
Right. So the initial outbreak actually occurred in July, but nobody bothered to tell anyone. And if you saw from multiple different news sources that there was a very a lag period from the time they actually contacted and let the public know that this had been out there and people were already sick. There was also right around in 2015 in late August, early September, there was also the time frame of we're utilizing the CDC recommendations of checking on people who weren't in care, people who were in the family portion. So the veterans home also has, besides where the veterans stay, there's a portion where family members could stay. And knowing that the outbreak was there, there was the recommendation that you had to check on people who were there and family members who were there, who lived in the other living facilities. And as I'm sure you've heard from some of the reporting, one of the women who passed away there had been deceased for a couple days, according to the coroner's report, so they weren't even following the basic recommendations of just checking on the residents. So if they weren't doing that, what else would they
have? And that was after a family member had called and inquired.
And it actually called up and said, where are they? What's going on? And they said, don't worry, we've been checking on them. Everybody's fine. And then later in the day, they called and said, oh, well, guess what? We found your mom passed away. And then when the coroner brought him in, the coroner said, no, she's been passed away for a few days.
I mean, part of, you, as you said before we went to break, part of this hearing is merely to try to get some basic questions
information,
answered.
Information, correct. A lot of this hearing is going to be based on getting information, what the state's going to do. We also need to know what the, look, obviously we didn't have a budget for 2 years, but to get this accomplished, there had to be some procurement. You know, we spent $6 million on a water treatment facility that still is allowing Legionnaires into these buildings. So what money was spent? How was it spent? And what was brought in? Who recommended the changes besides the CDC? What companies were brought in to do these recommended changes? What companies are doing the testing going forward? These are all things that need to be brought out to the public and need to be brought out to my fellow legislators. I went down and visited the facility last week. Okay, this is Christmas week, coming off of Christmas week. So the previous Tuesday, and drove down and spent about half a day down there, looked at the water treatment facility. It's a nice facility. It looks great, but yet it's still allowed six more cases and another fatality there. So what was done? How was it done? Who recommended it? Who actually approved it? Who signed off on it? How we got to the level we are? Why people said in 2016 that everything's fine, we have the cleanest water, we've done everything, that everybody will be good, and a year later we have the same issue. Why in 2015 was everything being hidden and everything being sort of kept and swept under the rug? So there's a lot of steps that we have to go through in this hearing. And we're going to be bringing in a lot of different agencies. We're going to be bringing in Veterans Affairs. We're going to be bringing in the governor's office. We'll have the CDC, whoever they have as their representative out here in Illinois. We'd like to bring up the Adams County Health Department to talk to them. We'd also like to talk to the people who down in Quincy who do the initial water coming out of before it gets to the veterans home. Remember, it goes through the city of Quincy before it even gets to the veterans home. So we want to talk to them as well. We're going to have that finalized this week with myself and my staff and members of the House hearing committee. So we should have that out and published, or at least push forward of who will be there on the 9th.
So I'm looking at an article from the from a newspaper down in the Quincy area, State Representative Dan Swanson, a Republican from Alpha, and mm-hmm. I have to say I'm not even sure where Alpha is, and I know where most every place is in the state of Illinois, but
Alpha's not as far south as Quincy.
But he says, according to the story, Swanson decried efforts by some members of the legislature to, quote, politicize the issue of veterans' health care. I would encourage members of the General Assembly to visit the Quincy Veterans Home to see firsthand the proactive measures instituted to keep all our veterans healthy and safe. That's what he says. What is the politicalization?
I don't know what the politicalization is that he would be talking about. I would hope he would want answers. I would hope he would want answers
why this happened. You toured it.
I toured it as well.
But there are still questions here.
There's still questions. There's still why is it occurring. There's still what's going to happen going forward. Just saying, well, they've been proactive and here's what's in place, that's good enough. I don't know how you can say that when there's still cases coming forward and somebody still died. Just saying that you went and visited and it's you've been proactive, well, you know, the state has been proactive, but why is it still happening? Why are we going to get there? Why? I mean, there are just too many questions. Who knew what when? Who approved all of the changes? Who didn't approve the changes? Who was holding information back from everybody while this was all going on? And have they really looked at every single possibility to stop this from occurring? Because it is still occurring. And then on the back end, we've had some members of the legislature say, or Senator Durbin had said, maybe we should get everybody out of there. The governor came forward, said he talked to many experts who said not to take people out. Well, who are the experts he talked to? Who are the people he talked to that said, don't move anybody out of there?
Well, and we also have the problem, too, where would people go?
That's one problem.
And we have the issue of the still unfinished Chicago Veterans Home.
You still have the issue of the unfinished Chicago Veterans Home. Where would you send people? And if our administration and our people are going to hide issues there, do we really trust them to move a frail population to multiple locations throughout the state? Because you're talking almost 400 residents. So we couldn't just go, and I don't think there's one facility in Quincy that could house 400 residents. So they'd have to go to other locations throughout the state, whether those are veterans' homes, private homes that the state would pick up while the veterans' home was being fixed. There are many different options, I would imagine, on the table, but who would you trust to coordinate that? Who would you actually put that responsibility on? If we've had this issue ongoing since 2015, would you now trust somebody to move an entire almost 400-plus frail population to various locations throughout the state? I don't know if I would trust that.
So there have been 11 lawsuits that have been filed
right
through the State Court of Claims, because it's a claim against the state for over deaths
right
here, have not been adjudicated yet.
Right.
But those claims are limited to $100,000.
Correct.
That's by statute.
Right.
And actually... A number of these people, based on the WBEZ's reporting, are saying we didn't necessarily file these to recover money as much as we want to just find out what happened.
I think their number one concern is what happened. Why weren't they told in a timely manner? What were they hiding? Would there have been enough time to move a family member had they known that this was going on? I mean, you saw the one case where they held actual treatment and were just giving aspirin to somebody who was showing the symptoms for, I believe, 7 days, 8 days, instead of actually starting the Legionnaire's treatment. So we really need to find out, truthfully, what's going to happen is, I think more what's going to come out of our hearings is going to be a lot of what's going on, what's going forward. I think you are going to see there's going to be a lot of questions about the governor's administration and where the time frame was in 2015, what the governor's administration, the veterans administration did going forward in 2016, how they put together all of the new water treatment plant, the new piping, the new shutting down of the old water tower and of the old boiler systems, and why what they've done since to keep this going forward.
But if the state is shown somehow to be culpable in those deaths, is that $100,000 claim sufficient?
Well, I think the $100,000 is, considering the suits that have gone against the state and considering the suits that have gone against municipalities, $100,000 is a very low number, considering somebody lost their life and considering somebody, you know, a family member passed away from something that was either treatable, which it is treatable, and it could have been hopefully avoided. I mean, when you start talking about that timeline from when the first case happened at the end of July till the CDC was brought in at the beginning of September on September 1, that's a huge timeline. That's not 12 hours of did we make a right decision. That's not somebody making a decision when they pull up to a crime scene. That's not any of that. That's a 34-day decision-making period that, you know, whether it be the Veterans Administration, the governor's office, the administration at the facility, somebody was not being forthcoming with all those people. And that's part of what we need to get done and hashed out in these hearings.
That's Democratic State Senator Tom Cullerton from Villa Park, chairman of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, Sunder, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well, Rick, and to all your listeners.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and we're going to spend this hour with a special roundtable. Joining me here in studio is Christopher Mooney, professor of political science at the University of Illinois at Springfield and part of the Institute for Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois system. And on the phone is my former colleague, Bob Sector, who's director of investigations for the Better Government Association. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Hey, my pleasure.
Just to kind of set the table, and you can take a break here. I have a piece from ABC News, which is their review of kind of the sights and sounds of what they consider the top headlines of 2017, starting with Robin Roberts.
The emotional farewell.
Yes, we did. Yes, we did. Thank you. God bless you.
This inauguration day of Donald J. Trump as the 45th president.
American carnage stops right now.
By the hundreds of thousands, they stream into the National Mall.
We are here to be respected.
Our information was held hostage.
The single biggest ransomware attack in the history of the Internet.
Dylan Roof sentenced to death.
We had to get justice.
After murdering 9 African Americans.
The biggest award, La La Land.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, Best Picture.
There has been an attack on the British Parliament.
You can see the car as it barrels across the bridge.
A man has been shot outside Parliament.
Oh my God.
Suicide bomber set off an explosion in an Ariana Grande concert.
There was smoke everywhere. There was blood on the floor.
You look fear right in the face and you say, no, we are Manchester and the world is watching.
A van plowing into pedestrians on London Bridge.
He was there to do one thing and one thing only, to kill people.
A van running over worshippers near a mosque in London.
This was an attack on Muslims.
A van has plowed into at least 100 people on the streets of Barcelona.
A sarin gas attack in Syria.
No one is doing anything to stop this.
Trump hitting Syria after that deadly chemical attack.
Tonight I ordered a targeted military strike.
Words of war.
They will be met with fire and fury.
The country can produce miniature nuclear warheads.
Rocket Man is on a suicide mission.
White supremacists and counter-protesters.
This car plowed down the street.
I've never seen such a horrific, blatant racist attack in my entire life.
You will not replace us!
And President Trump under fire.
I think there's blame on both sides.
I have recused myself.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions is stepping back from any investigation into Russian interference in the election.
Judge Neil Gorsuch sworn in to the highest court in the country.
So help me God. Congratulations.
And FBI Director James Comey terminated by President Trump.
He was not doing a good job.
Robert Mueller has been appointed to be the special counsel looking into Russia's interference in the 2016 election.
You are fake news.
It was fake news. Fake news.
Fake news.
It's all fake news. It's phony stuff.
House Majority Whip Steve Scalise and 3 others shot.
A deadlock and a mistrial.
Bill Cosby is a free man.
We're going to retry the case.
Women who spoke out initially against Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein, then others.
It is a movement.
Me Too, dominating social media.
We are here. We will not go away.
Time Magazine's Person of the Year, The Silence Breakers.
Harvey.
The storm is still blowing, and blowing its way sideways.
Catastrophic floods submerged one of the largest cities in the country.
We had a whole family out there in the water.
Rise of the human spirit that ran deeper than the floodwaters.
Hurricane Irma is right over us right now.
One of the most powerful storms ever recorded.
Death and destruction across the Caribbean.
The biggest catastrophe in Puerto Rican history.
A humanitarian crisis.
We can't let them die.
It looks like a bomb went off.
The deadliest fire disaster in state history.
And this looks like World War II.
The fires in Southern California continue to grow.
My house is on fire.
Thousands of people at a music festival.
We have an active shooter inside the warehouse.
The deadliest mass shooting in American history.
The deadliest terror attack here in New York City since 9/11.
I need an ambulance.
Killing at least 8 people with
the pickup truck.
Church massacre.
That church is my family.
26 killed and 20 others wounded in what is now the deadliest shooting in Texas history.
It'll be the first time in 99 years a total solar eclipse spanned the entire continental U.S.
The largest jackpot ever won by a single ticket.
I had a pipe dream, and my pipe dream has finally come true.
Prince Harry and Meghan Markle are engaged.
An American is about to marry into the royal family.
She chooses me, I choose her, but we're a fantastic team.
And that's ABC News look at the year 2017.
Yeah, nice to have a throw and a little bone at the end there, Rick. I'm going to go back to bed. That really was a terrible But the Royals, they're going to marry an American, so that's good. Exactly, that's working out.
Well, and you know, when you you talk about the year that was, but when you look back at all of these things that happened, and obviously, you know, with the new president, but also just the rise of terrorism, these lone wolf attacks, the rise of nationalism as a factor, you just have to wonder, where are we headed?
Well, that's always the story. In some ways, this year, past year, I mean, we hear a lot about sort of 1968. We're getting the 50th anniversary. It's 1968, the most tumultuous year, really, you know, in our lifetimes, our very long lifetimes. But boy, 2017 looks a lot like, in some ways, I mean, it's a precursor of a lot of big stuff coming and unprecedented action on all fronts. It's been rough.
Bob?
Yeah, it was it's been exhausting, and it seems like it's been 10 years, not 1 year, and since Donald Trump was inaugurated. And, you know, the question, I suppose, is can he keep up that pace without alienating the 30% of the country that still likes him? It really is. It's just, let's take a nap for a few days.
And even this holiday period wasn't necessarily, you know, much of a nap time. As long as there was access by the president to Twitter.
Right, and he's, you know, that's one of the things that's been really remarkable about him is this method of communication. Obviously, people remark that over time, but now we're kind of used to it. But is this, again, looking forward, are people who are serious presidential candidates going to have to do this in the future? Are they going to have to bare their souls? Are we have to see, you know, the sort of tawdriness of their internal thought processes? Is that what people are going to demand? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, what Twitter does, or what Twitter does for this president anyway, is it allows him to just sort of vomit out his every thought, and I'm not sure that anybody really wants that or that's good for anything. Sometimes it's good for everybody to take a breath before they say something, to think it through, and this guy doesn't.
Well, and Bob may appreciate this more than as a former colleague of mine, that I've already prepared for my headstone. It's going to be, everybody in life needs an editor.
Yes, exactly.
Okay?
Right.
Absolutely.
I just think that's a good way to go. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to a special roundtable on this New Year's Eve Sunday of the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. We're doing a year in review and look ahead roundtable with Bob Sector, Director of Investigations for the Better Government Association, and Chris Mooney, Professor of Political Science from the University of Illinois at Springfield. Since we were talking right before the break about President Trump and Twitter, and is this kind of the new style going forward, I want to play this clip from WGBH in Boston, the public television station there, which kind of compiled its review of this president and the press.
I hate some of these people, but I'd never kill them.
If you thought Donald Trump's hostility toward the press would fade after the election, you thought wrong.
These attempts to lessen the enthusiasm of the inauguration are shameful and wrong.
Right off the bat, the brand new administration hammered the media for accurately reporting the size of Trump's inaugural and allegedly ignoring terrorism.
It's gotten to a point where it's not even being reported.
A claim that's demonstrably false. Also drawing the president's ire, leaks involving possible collusion with Russia.
Mr. Trump reportedly floated the idea that Mr. Comey should consider putting reporters in prison.
As 2017 progressed, Trump retweeted an image of himself beating up CNN and made his contempt for the First Amendment abundantly clear.
It's frankly disgusting the way the press is able to write whatever they want to write.
In response, the press mounted a charm offensive.
A free press isn't the enemy of America. It's a big part of what makes America great.
And increasingly, we talked about the president with a tone that's unprecedented.
Is he fit for office?
He really is not capable of sequential thought.
Of course, Trump's approach to the White House is unprecedented, too.
The Supreme Court, the next justice.
So was that a surprise? Was it?
And once you've been pegged by the president as public enemy number one,
the news is fake.
Old school objectivity is hard to sustain.
That's from WGBH, the public television station in Boston. And it poses on a question. Is that old school objectivity is hard to sustain when you're under constant attack? And does that feed into kind of a narrative that Trump is helping to create by creating distrust of media as a source? Bob?
Well, he's only trying to create distrust of media when they expose inconsistencies or flip-flops or something wrong that he says. He certainly, first of all, media is not a monolith. It just, by definition, it isn't. And there's some media that he loves, take Fox and Friends, for example, but other media that has been more aggressive in pointing out his inconsistencies and, yes, let's say it, his lies. His only retort to that is, that's all fake. They made it up. Well, no, they didn't. But, you know, at some point, I would think that people are going to get tired of that, exhausted with that. Maybe he'll bring everybody down with him, but you know, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater forever.
Well, Chris, I mean, obviously, politicians and the press, especially if a politician feels that they're not getting their message across or being successful or being persecuted, it's always attack the media.
Yeah, I mean, that's an easy thing to do. The media has a higher reputation in general than does Congress and certainly this president. It's the crux of the big lie theory to keep hammering, as Bob was saying. You keep hammering and hammering and hammering. You say it over and over. Now, people are just going to get tired of, saying it's a lie or even just disbelieving psychologically. If you keep hearing this thing over and over again, you start, maybe it's true. And the media now is, as was mentioned, had to do a little bit of soul searching on this and really work to beef up their reputation. The CNN is a classic example of this. I mean, they have, arguably gone off the deep end. They're sort of gone to the where MSN space used to be, in the sense of being sort of an opposition. It looks like they're being an opposition to the president. It's just that they're just covering this so much of this negative news so often. That they have to be, they have to be a little careful about it. And they've gone through this, they've got ads on TV now that said, maybe your listeners have seen this, that this is an apple. They show a picture of an apple. Don't let anybody tell you it's not an apple, no matter what they say. And, they play it a lot. And I think the media needs to watch their image because it's, reputation is a delicate thing. You lose it and it's hard to get back.
So as we look ahead to 2018, obviously we have the special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation continuing. We've seen the New York Times this weekend write about George Papadopoulos, the Chicagoan who apparently on a boozy night with the with a high-ranking Australian official discussed how he had the opportunity to get Russian dirt from Russia on Hillary Clinton as kind of a pretext for the investigation. As long as the Mueller investigation continues, aren't we just going to keep hearing more of this is fake news?
I would think so. I mean, you know, look, how is this possibly going to end for Donald Trump? Either there's going to be some determination of collusion which brushes him, or the flip side of it is almost as bad for him, for a guy who proclaims that he's the smartest, greatest, most brilliant person in the world, is that he was played a fool by, he was asleep at the switch, wasn't taking a look at who he was hiring, and who he was hiring for his campaign was a bunch of people who were compromised by the Russians.
Yeah, you know, and this is a classic situation that the leaders in scandals find themselves in. Are you a crook? Are you stupid? And you know, George Brian, Rob Blagojevich, you know, you can name them. It almost always comes down to that. And you know, the narrative with Trump, though, that you described, that he didn't really know what he was doing. He got a bunch of yahoos for the campaign because none of the establishment. I mean, that that narrative sort of rings true, right? I mean, the guy was way in over his head. He got much farther than you thought he was going to go, even at the point where he won the primaries. And he was riding a wave, and little details like the legal niceties, and you know, I think went by the boards, and maybe they didn't even, you know, he probably wouldn't even think it far enough to realize he might actually win, because if he wouldn't have won, you know, would we have heard about much of this stuff? I don't know. Maybe yes, maybe no, but it certainly wouldn't have been in the papers every single day.
We've got a call from Lynn. Lynn, you're on the Sunday Spin.
Yeah, good morning. I was watching CNN last night, and they reported the news of the year, and they reported that ISIS has been defeated in the areas that they've been occupying with the help of Russia, and they omitted the very salient fact that the President Trump has changed the rules of engagement, and he has allowed the American military to do their job. So when you talk about the fake news, when you talk about the omission, when you talk about the suppression of news, it's absolutely real, and that's my comment.
Okay, Lynn, thank you for joining us. There's no doubt that among some media, there's shaping of news that goes on. And as you were saying, Chris, that CNN in many respects has gone over to be the opposing party to Donald Trump and MSNBC style ways.
Well, the you know, reporters and editors are, number one, they're human beings, and number two, they, with their job, I mean, and I can say this because I'm not a journalist, it's a very difficult job. You have to take, you know, a fire hose of information is coming at you every day from all different directions and try to make some sense out of it. And, you know, the montage at the top of the hour showed you how that is very, very difficult to do this year in particular, because, you know, what are the themes? How can you kind of summarize this stuff to a point where people can kind of understand what's going on? It's just not a bunch of random facts and weird, you know, tweets coming at them or weird events. But there's some narrative here, and that requires editing, and that requires judgment. And you know, journalism as a profession, that's what they do, and that is why we need them. Because if we don't have them, then who's going to be shaping that narrative? Is going to be people with a political interest, an ideological interest, an economic interest, something like that.
Bob?
Yeah, I mean, that caller, I mean, she exhibited a kind of classic critique of the media, which is, how come this story that I saw didn't mention everything that I think it should have mentioned? Well, stories never do. There's always stuff left on the cutting room floor. I mean, if you wanted completeness, I think you would also say that, yes, ISIS has been, is on the retreat greatly, perhaps almost totally in Syria and Iraq. But the expense, that was at the expense of the rebel factions that were trying to defeat the Assad regime in Damascus, which Trump has pretty much abandoned. So if you want completeness, you have to throw all that in. But you can't do that in every story.
We're speaking with Bob Sector, Director of Investigations for the Better Government Association, and Chris Mooney, Professor of Political Science at the University of Illinois at Springfield. This is the Sunday Spin.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. So glad to hear those temperatures rather than warming up. Seem to be getting colder. We're checking to see, we are hearing reports that we may have some audio difficulties with our signal, and we're doing our best to see what those problems might be. So please hang with us. And remember, you can always find our podcast, too, on iTunes. Just search for my name, Rick Pearson, or you can go to WGNradio.com, and you can also pick up the signal there and also be able to get our podcast. We're speaking with Bob Sector, Director of Investigations for the Better Government Association, and here in studio is Christopher Mooney, Professor of Political Science at the University of Illinois at Springfield. And we're kind of doing a year in review, a year look ahead. Let's look ahead. We're coming off our conversation about Donald Trump. 2018, a huge year of political consequences. You not only have the midterm elections for congressional seats, control of the House, perhaps, and control of the Senate, even, mm-hmm. perhaps at stake. And then you bring it on home to Illinois, where you have Republican Governor Bruce Rauner in a primary contest. Questions about where his favorability is right now, while you have a cast of characters on the Democratic side vying for the Democratic nomination. Everybody at this early stage nationally talks about the potential for a Democratic wave coming in November. Is it too premature to Bob Sector to talk about that?
Yes. I mean, you know, just look at the last year. I mean, we have been, you know, hit by consequence after consequence, controversy after controversy. So trying to predict what's going to happen between now and next November is going to be really hard, and we don't know which cycle on the roller coaster we're going to be at that time. I mean, certainly the arrow appears to be pointing up for Democrats, but they've got a lot of there are a lot of technical reasons why this could still be a tough sell for them in the Senate. The odds would appear to be stacked against them because they simply have far more incumbents up for re-election than do Republicans. And in the House, we talk about gerrymandering in Illinois, but, you know, gerrymandering problems in the rest of the country are as bad or worse, and they're stacked for Republicans. So it's a tough sell for Democrats.
Chris Mooney?
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt about that. And I think any of us that, you know, are in the punditry business, so to speak, got a wake-up call a year ago, November. And so and people are all very leery about talking about the future, at least I certainly am. As a political scientist, I'm much better explaining why things happen. It couldn't have happened any other way, you know, than to talk about in the future. But, I mean, the fact that you've got a historically unpopular president in his first term, exposure because they have recently won the sort of marginal seats, especially in the House, and also on the gubernatorial level across the country, they're exposed. They're like with Rauner, there are governor seats that the Republicans won 4 years ago that they probably, under normal circumstances, wouldn't have won. It's just that it was a Republican, so they picked up the marginal ones, and that's what this generally is all about. That's why the president loses in the midterm, because the president picks up the marginal seats because of his or her popularity in when they won, and then 2 years later, the natural course of events is for presidential popularity to decline to some extent. But even if you don't, you just go back to normal, and some of those marginal seats go the other way.
Well, let's talk about Governor Rauner's reelection bid, and after a very rough year.
Very rough.
For the governor, where in his ideological battle between himself and House Speaker Mike Madigan, no budget. Finally, we get a budget resolution, but only after 15 Republicans cross over and vote with Democrats to enact over his veto a budget and tax increase. He changes his staff and brings in people from the Illinois Policy Institute, realizes that didn't go well, gets rid of them. Has a new incarnation of staff. He has House Bill 40. That's the bill that expanded taxpayer-subsidized abortions for poor women and women covered by state employee health insurance. He does that after earlier saying he would veto it, after having previously as a candidate telling an abortion rights group that he supported absolutely and worked for the goals of such legislation. That spawns a primary challenge from the right, from three-term Republican State Representative Jeannie Ives from Wheaton. Rauner has the money, but does Rauner have a base?
No, and that's the crazy thing about this. He's been all over the place. I hark back a little bit to what I said about Trump earlier. He's ineffective or he's just clueless. That's what he looks like. And now he has, he won last time because he was able to convince a lot of suburbanites that he had no social agenda. Well, now he can be labeled as having a social agenda. It's not the social agenda his base wants. So now he's in a real pickle. Who does he appeal to in the primary? And that's the real question. He's got more money than God, but can he survive a primary? And I'm not sure he can.
Chris?
Well, the Republican primary electorate, or selectorate, as they sometimes call it, because they select the candidate, in Illinois, historically, there's been about, 20-25% movement conservatives, people that are just, like a Jeannie Ives, very, very strong social agenda, very, very ideologically driven. And, when you put one up against a sort of typical moderate Republican, the ones that win statewide in the state of Illinois, you see about, 20-30% going that way. So you see, Jim Edgar, Jack Rosa took Jim Edgar on in 94 and he got like, I think 27-30%, something like that. So, and that's when Edgar was actually quite popular in those days. So she's gonna get, then you get the personality thing in there, or maybe she's gets a little bit more because she's really attracted to some of these people. Maybe she gets a little bit less because she says something, but she's going to get in that ballpark. And he's going to win the primary. And so in some sense, having her on the right might sharpen him up for the general. And this might be one of the better things that happened to him. But that requires you to have the sort of political skill and strategic vision that most people who have been in government for a while have, or in politics for a while have, though this particular governor, being a neophyte, doesn't seem to have a lot of strategic vision, almost on any front. He has it, but he can't get it done. Let's put it that way.
Well, he told us he wasn't a politician, so I suppose that's true.
Well, that's right. And he's also not in charge, as he's told us.
That's right.
Yeah.
Which I think maybe the I would consider almost the most memorable quote of 2017.
Absolutely. It really reminds me a lot of when Jeb Bush was speaking in New Hampshire in January of 15 or 16, I guess, whatever. And he made a comment and he said, please laugh, or please clap, or whatever it was to the people. And I mean, it made him look hapless. And that's what this makes the governor look hapless and helpless.
I thought you were going to evoke Jimmy Carter's malaise speech.
There's something to that. I think Jimmy Carter actually thought that through, and they were editing. Uh-huh. What word should we use here? I don't think Jeb Bush was thinking it, and I don't think Bruce Rauner was thinking to say this.
Everybody in life needs an editor.
There you go.
That's the catchphrase for 2018.
There you go.
We're talking to Bob Sector and Chris Mooney. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Back to a special New Year's Eve edition of the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson speaking with Chris Mooney from the University of Illinois at Springfield and Bob Sector from the Better Government Association. Right before the break, we were talking about Bruce Rauner and the primary with Republican three-term Representative Jeannie Ives. And we're saying about, you know, what is the governor's base? And it's kind of interesting because in signing the expansion of abortion rights, that could necessarily be viewed as a way to reach out to socially moderate suburban women who are a key demographic block in Illinois politics and Republican politics, mm-hmm. too. But at the same time, he went on the air and to a downstate radio station in Heron that's well listened to, and was asked by Tom Miller, the host there, well, what do you say to these Republicans that are upset with you about signing that abortion bill? And his response was, there's no bigger supporter of pro-life candidates than me. And so, you know, what does that say if you're attracting, you're trying to attract those social moderates?
Well, I think that what it shows is, again, that Rauner has a little bit of a political tin ear, and that this, I mean, he's undoubtedly correct that he's the biggest supporter of pro-life candidates, because he's the biggest supporter of every Republican candidate. I mean, it's his money that's funding the Republican Party for the last few years. But is that, you know, just to say that, yes, I signed the abortion bill, but I'm really helping pro-life, I mean, that does not help you with the pro-life people. Doesn't help you with either side, because this is an issue. If you've got to basically pick a side and go with it, and you can't play both sides on this one. I mean, you could have a moderate sort of approach, like the sort of average American who says, yes, I think it should be, as Bill Clinton once said, safe, available, and rare. And that seems to be what the American public is, where they sit on this. But it's tough as a politician, because you do have to sort of go with one approach.
Well, Bob Sector, one of the questions I had too is when he brought up this line with the downstate radio station, he, in signing the bill, he talked about his support for this bill reflected his personal values, and it raised the question, what does value mean?
Well, I'm not sure what his personal values are. Is the problem? Remember, in the last election, he was actually fairly straightforward on the abortion issue when asked about it at various campaign appearances by very conservative Republicans. At the same time, he cozied up to a guy named Jack Roser, who is one of the most prominent anti-abortion people in the state, and he managed to sort of thread that needle. I don't think you're going to do it again after signing HB 40. And it just makes it, he seems to be digging himself into a hole. And I'm, as Chris said, I think he's got a tin ear and doesn't seem to understand that or doesn't want to understand it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I want to shift here in the just couple minutes we have left to the Democratic primary for governor. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing the kind of establishment forces have coalesced around J.B. Pritzker. Obviously, Pritzker self-funding his candidacy. That also is a strategic element, I think, for the Democrats in the establishment. Chris Kennedy's out there still relying very much on the name recognition factor, and then you've got Daniel Biss kind of on the outside playing the Bernie card.
Right. Yeah, it's a pretty healthy field, though. You know, and Pritzker obviously has the inside track. It's like Pearl Bailey once said, you know, I've been rich, I've been poor, rich is better. And in this case, I think the same thing with Rauner. I mean, because Rauner's got, I mean, the most salient factor about the Rauner campaign, other than his incumbency at this point, and has been for the last 5 years, is the guy is willing to spend any amount of money that exists to do what he needs to do. And Pritzker obviously takes that away from him, and because he can actually outspend Bruce Rauner if he feels like it, because apparently he's got more money, though I don't know how you count that high, so it's hard to know.
That's why you went into political science.
That's right. Business didn't work out, so engineering. But the problem with Pritzker, and I would say to some extent with Kennedy as well, is that these are neophyte unknown candidates who typically do not do well in the state of Illinois. Now, Rahner is the one exception, I guess, along with Peter Fitzgerald, but that was a little bit of a weird case. And so we might think everything has changed. But the key thing with these rich guys is that we don't know, if they haven't been through the fire yet, where they might trip up. And where is Pritzker's weak point? Did he punch his wife in the ankle in a divorce hearing? I mean, like we heard about with Blair Hull. You know, I mean, these things happen. So he could blow up at any moment.
The one thing that that you hit on, Chris, that is an interesting but somewhat disturbing phenomenon, is that if you're going to look at the trend in progressive politics, is money has taken over politics, and the Democratic answer to the money of Bruce Rahner is to find a guy who's even richer. What does that say about where we're going?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Very difficult to know. And Illinois is a place where this doesn't usually happen. I mean, people are successful here because they build a base, they start from a local base, and they work up, or some ideological. That is one of the problems with Bruce Rahner. He never had that. He came in, he flew in, parachuted in, and never had that grassroots base. So when he had this, these hiccups in the last 6 months, after the dam broke, there was no there left. I mean, what's he going to do? Is he's got no base. What is his base? His base is not the conservatives. His, you know, does he have a geographical base? You might say, well, maybe it's among, you know, the four or five people he plays cards with, and that have funded his campaign. But he can't fall back like most Illinois politicians can on to a base they can rely on.
Gentlemen, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave that right there. I want to thank you so much for being part of our special year-end roundtable. Bob Sector, Director of Investigations with the Better Government Association, and Christopher Mooney, Professor of Political Science at the University of Illinois at Springfield and part of the Institute for Government and Public Affairs with the University of Illinois System. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Rick.
Thanks.
Happy New Year.